Good evening and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay and I'm delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Gail McLeod, who's Senior Lecturer at the University of Edinburgh. And we're going to be talking about a couple of Gail's projects this evening, loosely based around the theme of closing the gap. So welcome to EduTalk, Gail.
Thank you very much.
And just to start off with, for the benefit of listeners, could you give us a brief background to your career in education and academia?
Sure. Well, I've been working at Murray House now for, I think about 12 years. Before that, I did my PhD starting about 2000 and finished about 2005. Before that, I was a teacher in schools for kids with behavioural problems. Worked in about three different schools across Scotland. And for about 5 years before that, I'd worked as a residential care worker in various residential therapeutic communities and local authority childcare units and things.
And for maybe the benefit of some of our listeners further afield, you know, what do we mean when we talk in Scotland about closing the gap? I mean, I suppose with the background you've just illustrated there, Gail, you're acutely aware that it might be a number of gaps, or it might be a lot more difficult to kind of put a finger on than some might imagine.
I think, I mean, for me, when I talk about it, what I mean is that a young person's educational outcomes ought not to be determined by the circumstances of the family and the location to which they're born. You know, it shouldn't be about their postcode. It should be about their ability. So that's really what we find is, and across all the UK, is we find that persistently there is a close association between growing up in disadvantage and not performing as well as more advantaged peers in school. So it's about trying to make that impact of growing up in poverty to be lessened and to make sure that everybody's, you know, got a level playing field, really.
What kind of work have you been involved in then in the past? I mean, we'll hear about the Read, Write, Count project in a moment, but you know, you said you've been in the university for a while and I know you're very committed to social justice, equity, etc. So what have you been involved in up till now?
Well, to be honest, most of my work until now has focused on young people who are described as having challenging behaviour in schools. I mean, that was obviously my practitioner background, first as a care worker, then as a teacher, and that continued through my PhD, where I was looking at young people's experiences of two different schools for children who were no longer able to be educated in the mainstream. They were excluded from school, and they looked at two different schools, which had very different ethoses. And was interested in exploring the young people's experiences of those different regimes, if you like. And since then, I've also done work for the Westminster government looking at the outcomes for young people who are not just excluded from mainstream school, but who then get excluded from wherever they go to next. So, you know, we often think of special schools as sort of the end of the line, but actually each year there are some young people who are not able to manage there. And so there's very few of them, but it's important to know what happens to them. So that was a sort of a three-year longitudinal project I was involved in. And more recently, I think my interest has turned to looking particularly at issues around the medicalisation of disruptive behaviour. So we know that young people are quite often diagnosed with a disruptive behaviour disorder, like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or they may get the more kind of administrative label of social-emotional behavioural difficulties. And we also know that there's some young people who are kind of fairly persistently in trouble at school, but they don't meet the diagnostic category for one of the kind of medical conditions, and neither do they get the administrative category of SEBD. So I'm interested in exploring young people's experiences, both of being medicalised, if you like, being told that there's something wrong with them, but also the experiences of young people who don't get that label and what that means for them.
So the Read, Write, Count project would be something quite materially different then in some ways from the work.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have to say that there is a very clear association between social class and being identified as having a disruptive behaviour disorder in school. So we know that growing up in disadvantage means that you are much more likely to be identified as having challenging behaviour in the school context. There's lots and lots of different explanations for why that might be. But there's always been, so with it, even when in my earlier work looking at behaviour, there's always been an interest in social class as kind of an explanatory variable when we're trying to understand the experiences of young people. So it's perhaps not quite as wild a departure as it seems like, but it's certainly new territory for me. What's interesting in the Read Write? I mean, do you want me to start talking about the Read Write Camp
project? Great to hear about the kind of background and aims,
Sure. So, I mean, it's a very small project, but I think one of its strengths is that it's a very small project. So I'll say a wee bit about how it started. I got into conversations as a representative of Moray House, really, with City of Edinburgh Council, trying to think through ways in which we as a school, the School of Education, could help out in practical terms in closing the attainment gap. There's obviously a lot of excellent research going on in Moray House that translates into practice. We've got some brilliant researchers working there. But this was more to find out, is there anything a bit more directly practical that we could do? We wanted to be making our contribution. So I started having conversations with representatives from City of Edinburgh Council. And we kind of agreed that the biggest resource we had really was our students. These are our, young people who are committed to a career in teaching, who are still at that very, bright-eyed kind of stage of the career where they want to do new things and try new things and soak up the experience. And so we also identified an area of activity in the council that really, under current austerity and different, funding cuts, is difficult for local authorities to deliver all the services that they would like to. And one of these areas that was clearly identified where councils would like to be able to be doing more is in the role of family learning, particularly family learning to promote parental engagement. Now, it's really important to say that what we have is some students working with family learning workers across Edinburgh. And we are not at all trying to say that these students who have only been in professional education for, I think, about 6 months when they started, we're not at all trying to say that they can replicate the work of family learning workers. But the hope was that by sitting in workshops with the family learning workers who were doing workshops with parents of primary one pupils, that they would be introduced to the school and they'd understand what the purpose of the workshop was, and then that they would offer workshops to parents of primary two and primary three pupils. And these would be parents who'd previously had workshops in the earlier years. So what we were trying to do was build on the kind of excellent working relationships the family workers had already established in the schools. And we asked for student volunteers, so we got about a dozen students volunteering. So they went and shadowed the family learning workers. And then they went and offered their own workshops for the parents of slightly older pupils. And this was all around the book gifting activity of the Scottish Book Trust. So the Scottish Book Trust for a number of years now has been doing gifting of books to preschool and primary one pupils. And this year, for the first time, they've extended that to primary two and primary three, and they've added numeracy materials into the resource packs that go out to homes. So any of you out there who are parents of primary one, two or three pupils in a Scottish primary school will have received, hopefully, a Scottish Book Trust gift bag with resources for parents to help in work with their children at home or play with their children and, give them an idea of the kinds of activities going on in schools. So what family learning workers do is they go into schools and they invite parents in and they come and they have workshops and activities. They do kind of games together. They do reading activities together. And it's really about building confidence. It's also an opportunity for parents to share their experience of things that they've found works with their children at home. And it's really, I think, helping parents to see what skills they have already and that actually they can make a huge contribution to the children's learning. And, in everyday activities, they're involving numeracy and literacy skills in a way that perhaps isn't obvious to somebody who's not got an education background, but those skills are there. So it's really about building parental confidence and sharing ideas and that kind of thing. And so we thought it would be great to have these students go and work alongside the family learning workers and do some workshops themselves. And then we thought, well, actually, if we're going to do this, it would be a nice idea to see what effect this has, if any. Now, it's very small scale, so we're absolutely not making any claims to generalizability. But I just wanted to involve more students because it's such a nice opportunity. So every year, our final year BEd primary education students do a research project. So seven of them volunteered to use this small Read Write Count project as the basis for their final year project. So there's two groups of students, the ones who are volunteering doing the workshops, and then the BEd 4 students who are evaluating or investigating, exploring, might be a fairer way to say it, different aspects of the experience. And then this has all been coordinated by a kind of a steering group, which involves people from, Cleo from the City Library Services, Evelyn, who's a literacy strategy coordinator, Anne Rennick, an educational psychologist, Barry McNeil's been there representing the family learning workers, but all the family learning workers have been involved. And our head teacher, Maureen Allen, was involved in the student group for a bit, and some of the students have been coming along to these meetings whenever possible. And then we've had Antonio and Jennifer from the Scottish Book Trust as well. So it's been a really, really nice group of people from different bits of practice, all meeting around the table together, talking about ways in which we can help student teachers understand the importance of parental engagement and using it actually as a model for kind of working between the university, local authorities and other agencies is in a way that, that benefits everybody. I mean, the way I see this project is everybody's getting something out of it. It's not as if the university's giving something to the schools, because actually our students, I think, are gaining a huge amount from it, you know, this exposure to the work of the family learning workers and the experience of being part of a research team as well. So I think it's one of those kind of really nice win-win projects. And its strength really is just in the relationships that have built up between people from the university and then people from different, from the Scottish Book Trust and from different departments within the City Council and, of course, the students.
Fascinating, Gail. And I wonder, you know, to what extent are the students going to be able to share their findings of the project?
So, well, they will write up their findings for the dissertation. That's the first thing they have to do by the 2nd of May. So that's kind of pressing on their minds at the moment. That's their goalpost. But also, I'm delighted that the head of school, School of Education, Rhian Arshad, has agreed that the school will host a dissemination event. And this is going to be on the 5th of June. It'll be on, I think that's a Monday, the 5th of June. And we'll have we have one of the vice principals or assistant principals from the university who's got a responsibility for community relations is going to come and open the event. And then the different groups of students will present their findings. So we're going to have some of the PGDE students talking about their experiences of volunteering and what they liked about it, what they learned from it. And then I think it's 3 or 4 of the BEd students are going to present the findings. Some of them have already booked holidays, unfortunately. And I wouldn't cancel them, surprisingly enough. I can't understand that. But I think at least 4 of them are going to present their findings. And then there'll be some contributions from members of the steering group that I was talking about as well, just talking about our reflections on this as a model of practice. So that half-day event, we're going to be inviting head teachers, literacy coordinators, representatives from Scottish Government, teaching unions, whoever wants to come along, be very welcome. And actually part of the plan for that day as well is partly sharing the research findings, but it's also... And the more I do of this educational research thing, the more I realise you just have to spend time with people. You know, it's so much of it is about networking. It's about having the time to listen to what practitioners or policymakers are telling you are the issues that they're facing and they need questions to. And the less as academics we can be isolated in our supposedly ivory towers, and the more we can actually, you know, be with people who are, you know, the end users of our research, if you like, then the more useful our research will be. So I'm really looking forward to that day.
Yeah, and it sounds as if this event and the research itself and the project may help to continue to make BookBug successful and sustainable.
Well, I hope so. I think we're learning some things from the work that the students have carried out. And the other thing, this project itself of having student volunteers, although it might not be assessed every year by BEd students, we're certainly hoping to replicate the volunteering part of it next year with students. So we're hoping that the project itself will become sustainable. There's a lot of evidence. A colleague of mine from social policy at Edinburgh University, Emma Davidson, had done an evaluation of the BookBug for the younger years. And so they are constantly evaluating. I think Scottish Book Trust are really good at constantly kind of asking those questions. Are we doing the right thing? What could we be doing better? There's certainly some things. One of my students is focusing on the experiences of literacy coordinators, and some of the things we've identified already is that maybe there's something about the timing of when we need to do training for teachers. So these packs of books arrive in the school. How can we make sure that schools are in a position to use them most effectively? And the Scottish Book Trust have got some fantastic online resources. So basically, it's a whole term's worth of teaching, if you want, or, you know, based around these materials that are being sent out home. So the idea that these materials can be used in the classroom as well. And I think actually there's still a bit of work to be done that we've identified in just raising teachers' awareness about just quite how rich a resource it is that the Scottish Book Trust have there. And so in order to do that, of course, the books are gifted to coincide with Scottish National Book Week, I think. I'll get in trouble if I get this wrong, but it's in November, I know that. And actually by the time the books get there, all the teachers, of course, have made their forward plans. for that term. We need to be doing this earlier and make sure that gets into the planning around it gets into schools earlier. So I think really practical things like that have come out of it, I think the resources themselves are brilliant. I mean, another student, Robin Ivory, is a fourth year student, and her research that she's focusing on is the use of read-write-count materials with families where English is an additional language. And I think there's maybe, you know, there's some work that could be done there in terms of, particular assistance that can be given to families. We know how important parental engagement is in closing the attainment gap. We know how important parents feeling valued and respected by schools and feeling schools are places that they're welcome, and teachers feeling able to talk freely with parents. We know how important that is for pupil progress. And we know that fundamental parental engagement is good, clear communication. So obviously, if English isn't your first language, and if your teacher is can't speak Polish or Urdu or whatever the home language is, that's going to be an issue, an additional challenge. And we know how busy teachers are with lots and lots of other things to do as well. So is there something perhaps that Scottish Book Trust could be doing, or can other organisations maybe come in and help and think about ways in which these resources can be adapted to be, you know, particularly helpful for families who don't come from households where English is the main language. So that's one little thing that Robin's identified. But the other students are each of them. So it's nice. Each of them has found something quite interesting, you know, which is great for them actually, because it's nice to do real research when you're a student teacher, I think.
Yeah, of course. And just before we go on to hear about another project that you're putting together just now, Gail, I'm thinking about the kind of key places to go to get further information would be Scottish Book Trust, I suppose. But what about to actually find out more about this event on the 5th of June?
I don't think it's up advertised on Eventbrite yet, because we're still putting final touches to the programme. So if anybody is interested, the easiest way is just to contact me. So that's just Gale, Gale.MacLeod, MacLeod, @ed.ac.uk.
Okay, that's lovely.
Yep.
Great stuff. And the project that you're putting together just now, I had a wee chuckle to myself because, we talk about interdisciplinary in many different contexts in Scottish education, but as I understand it, we're with this project, you're looking to bring together people from different disciplines around a young person, for example, psychology, education. I'm thinking back to my current practice and going back many years as well, working really closely with social care workers. In that particular context, can you tell us about this project that you're putting together just now?
Sure. So this project is at the stage of me trying to get money to do it, which seems to be the stage that lots of my projects get to, but such is the life of an academic researcher. So and actually it's an exciting opportunity because it's the university itself has made some funding available internally, because the university is committed to trying to promote interdisciplinarity in research. I think increasingly as we look at the global challenges that we face across the world, people are beginning to realise, nothing's really that simple. And in order to try and understand things and come up with solutions for global problems, we really need to have a whole range of different disciplines involved in trying to kind of understand what's going on and make sense of things. So there's some funding available to kind of, pump prime little groups of people working on particular areas. And so, of course, I was saying earlier, the area I'm interested in is behaviour in school. And actually, what I'm interested in is how pupil behaviour in school might be part of the connection between poverty and attainment, because we know that, we've known for a long, long time, that growing up in a disadvantaged household means you're more likely to be identified as having behaviour problems in school. And we also know it's likely to lead to less than ideal educational outcomes. And so is there perhaps a connection there? And if we can work out what it is that's causing the behaviour problems, or young people to be identified as having behaviour problems, then maybe that can be part of addressing the issue of closing the attainment gap. Now, when you look at different explanations for why there is this association, and nobody doubts the association is there, whatever discipline you look at. But when you look at, how might we understand and explain this association between poverty, growing up in disadvantage, and poor behaviour in school? There is a huge range of different explanations. Even within one discipline like sociology, you'll get lots of different kinds of explanations depending on what kind of view of the world you take and how you think things are explained. So, for example, a classic social conflict, class-based approach would say that one of the reasons why young people from poorer backgrounds misbehave in school is because the curriculum is inappropriate for them. That's a kind of a classic sort of 1970s argument about the knowledge that they have from home, and the home knowledge is not the knowledge of the curriculum, and so they feel rejected by it. There are other, Paul Willis's Learning to Labour book from 1977 is all about working class culture and the reproduction of social class inequalities. But Paul Willis is talking about young people kind of actively rejecting the dominant working class culture and choosing to reproduce their own culture. And then you have more interactionist accounts which kind of talk about the creation of deviant subgroups and labelling and secondary deviance and that kind of thing. And so even amongst sociologists, I think if I'm anything, I'm probably broadly an educational sociologist. My background is philosophy and theology, which is why I'm not clearly saying I'm a sociologist, but that's kind of where I probably have most affinity. But even amongst sociologists, there are huge differences of opinion about how we might best understand this link. So then you look at psychologists and, you know, again, there's this huge range of explanations, and some of it focus on parenting, some of it focus on things like prenatal maternal health, and looking at connections between, so for example, healthy diet during pregnancy and brain development. So we know that from research psychologists have done, neuropsychologists have done, that actually growing up in poverty seems to be associated with deficits in what they call frontal lobe executive functions. And these are precisely the kinds of deficits that you'd associate with things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So poor impulse control and interference suppression and things like that. So those are kind of psychological explanations. You've got your sociological explanations. But then, of course, you've also got much wider explanations about, you know, what's it like growing up in poverty, maybe having multiple house moves, what kind of diet's available, you know, the pressure on parents. We know that most kids living in poverty are actually living in families where people are working. It's not this kind of myth of this kind of generational kind of people who are, you know, never in jobs and things. But we know people who are living in poverty where, you know, mum's got three part-time jobs. And what's it like growing up in, you know, in a crowded house where you're sharing a room with your siblings, there's no room for homework, you've maybe got damp running down the walls, and it's the third house you've lived in that year, and you don't really know where you're going to be living in a few weeks' time. So that whole kind of much, much broader kind of social impact of poverty, there's research done recently down south which just looked at the environment around schools. You know, if you're walking to school and you're passing shopping trolleys turned over in the park and windows broken and, you know, litter lying around, what does that say to you about how you are valued as a member of society? And you know, this idea that the environment in which you live kind of sends these messages to people about what we think they're worth, which in turn they internalize. And so we need to think, I think, not just about psychological measures or sociological explanations, but much more broadly looking at society as a whole and how that might help us understand. And then, of course, that's just within, you know, disciplines I'm fairly confident on. But if you start talking to neuroendocrinologists, I can't even say their name properly, they would have explanations. We look at things like levels of cortisol, which is apparently a stress hormone. And the idea is that if you are exposed to stressful situations as an infant, so perhaps we know that, for example, maternal health is also has a link with poverty. So if you're born to a mum who's living in disadvantage, your mum is more likely to be suffering from postnatal depression and may more likely to be attachment issues, clearly, because, you know, parenting is difficult anyway. Sorry, that's my dog. It's much, much more difficult. Sorry about that. It's much, much more difficult to parent in poverty. There's a woman at South Bank Poly in London, and Val Gillis, who writes beautifully about the difficulties and the challenges of parenting from a kind of a working class background or from disadvantage. So you're looking at a young mum maybe, or even an older mum like myself, who has a difficult time when the baby's first born. The baby maybe then is crying a lot. There's maybe poor attachment. The baby's getting very stressed. And so what happens is the baby's releasing this stress hormone. And the theory is that actually there comes a point where you've just released so much stress hormone that you get immune to it, that you no longer get that kind of physical response to the stress hormone that your body's releasing, because you're just doing it all the time. If that physiological response persists into school age, And then especially into adolescence, where we start looking at risk-taking behaviour, a normal part of adolescence is to take risks, right? That's why it's usually teenagers on the railway line or walking along the wall or doing all these kind of things which parents are going, oh, no. And part of the theory there is that young kids who at a very, very early age have had overexposure to the stress hormone will take bigger risks because they don't have that physiological response telling them they're taking a risk because the body's immune to it because they were releasing so much stress hormone at birth. Now, I have to confess, I'm not a neuroendocrinologist. You might have guessed that. So that's my understanding of what their or one of the explanations from that discipline might be. But, you can begin to see how actually there are so many different things which are going on in which might be, and of course, for each individual child, it's going to be slightly different as well, a different combination. But there's so many different things that happen as a result of growing up in disadvantage that actually to say to a school, right, you need to fix this, begins to look a little unfair, you know, because actually there's probably a limit to what schools on their own can do, given how much is happening outside school and what kids are already, you know, we know that the attainment gap is there already at age 3. You know, so to say to a school, by the way, you need to close the attainment gap on top of all the other things that you're doing and making copious notes about it, you know, seems a big ask for schools to be able to do that. So I think what I'm interested in doing is gradually building up a network of academics who come at this problem from the different disciplinary perspectives, just to see if we can find ways of working together to kind of pool all the different bits of expertise and different bits of knowledge and understanding and the different insights. One of the things we're aiming for is, it took me a long time to get my head around this, but there is a difference between multidisciplinary research and interdisciplinary research. So multidisciplinary research is where you just have, sorry, I shouldn't say just, because even this is difficult enough, but you have researchers from different disciplines working together, and each person or each discipline generates their data, analyzes the data in the way that they would within their discipline, and then they kind of look at the results and they say, oh, well, this says this and that says that. How might we understand, you know, what's going on here? But each, what you often find there is the social science, the kind of the more qualitative stuff is quite often the kind of the smaller partner, you know, the interviews with people is the bit to kind of flesh out what the proper scientific research has found is kind of the way it's sometimes characterized. Interdisciplinary research is different because the idea is that actually we want to have researchers who are working together who manage to reach a shared understanding about the nature of the phenomena that they're trying to study and how all that data might come together and, you know, present a much more holistic picture of what's going on. And I think a lot of interdisciplinary research is just about, it's a bit like the family learning work and the read-write counseling. It is just people from different perspectives sitting around the table, spending time together, getting to know each other, getting to develop, you know, a trust in each other's professional judgment and then feeling comfortable taking risks with each other and, you know, trying to reach a kind of a shared understanding about what's going on. So I'm really excited about it. I'm working, the bid is going to go in with a colleague from social policy, Morag Trainer, who's doing lots of work with I know she's been working with John Hayward at City of Edinburgh Council on raising awareness of poverty and doing some interventions for teachers there to help teachers understand the impact of living in poverty. And I think she's been working with the Child Poverty Action Group as well. And Charles Marley, who is a clinical psychologist who has an interest in links between poverty and mental health.
So already there's the kind of the potential there for, you know, truly interdisciplinary analysis that you've actually started to build that in, you know, right from the design stage.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is that we wouldn't do anything, you know, the next step, if we get the money, the next step is, and even actually probably if we don't, but is to start having conversations with practitioners and head teachers and really just begin to find out what, you know, how they would go about answering this question, what things they would like us to be looking at, what disciplines they think ought to be involved. I mean, I think the more you can involve practitioners and policymakers in the design of research and telling you what questions they want answers to, the more useful your research is going to be. I mean, obviously, academia has to bring something to that. There has to be an added value of getting researchers in there to do it. I mean, I'm slightly concerned with, again, there seems to be more of a focus again on what works research. Notes the Scottish Government report that's published today about, the agenda for research and education. What works comes up a lot. And I think actually, as academics, part of what we need to do is, I mean, to be fair to the report, actually does also talk about the importance of blue skies thinking and, you know, this kind of, you know, independent research things. But, you know, it's not just what works, but it's why does it work? And why didn't it work then? You know, we need to be moving beyond that kind of, you know, that kind of mechanistic thing. And I think that's the kind of thing that I think as academics, we need to not just answer the research questions that practitioners and policymakers have, but we need sometimes to be able to suggest questions that don't always occur to people who are right in the middle of practice. So, you know, it's really difficult when you're working in a school and you're working in a policy regime to get your head above water enough to say, not just to say, well, this is the policy goal, so how are we going to get there? But to actually say, well, why is this the policy goal? And whose interests are being served by this? And, you know, those kinds of questions, which are sort of challenging dominant discourses in the field. So I think research has to be this kind of, you know, the generation of research design research questions is at its best when it is a genuine kind of partnership between practitioners, policymakers and academics. And I think each group has something unique to bring to that. So that will be the next step, and I think the funding deadline is the end of this month. And it's the sort of project that it would be great if we got internal funding for it, and if we don't, we'll look somewhere else for funding as well. There's a lot of support nationally, I think, for this kind of research, which is looking beyond the kind of single mono, you know, answers that try and make kind of simplistic assumptions between things. We want to avoid saying it's all growth mindset or attachment or brain gym, that kind of thing, you know, right. A bit more nuanced.
Yes, indeed. And so, I mean, all the best with the application and then the project when it comes together and makes its first steps forward. But, I mean, just to finish up with, Gail, then, around whatever we mean by closing the gap, you know, what else is going on within the university that might be of interest to people with an interest in this field or indeed nationally with colleagues further afield?
Yeah, I mean, I know more about Edinburgh than I do about elsewhere. I mean, I work closely with colleagues there. I mean, I do know, though, that Glasgow University have got some really interesting work going on where they're working closely with local schools and have been for a number of years now on links between poverty and attainment. And Stephen McKinney from Glasgow is one of the people that's involved there. And they've got some really interesting work, and they've got especially a team looking at literacies and family literacy there, which is really interesting. More locally at Edinburgh, there's such a large school of education. There's lots of different things going on. There's the people like Sheila Riddell who look at widening participation, which is kind of the other end of closing the gap. Christine Iannelli, Lindsay Patterson, and colleagues like that looking at things around how subject choice in secondary school can make a big difference. Again, this is about, you know, access to higher education, but what they find is that actually the subjects that your child chooses, and speaking as the mother of a child in S3 who's just about to go into S4, who's just chosen her subjects, that actually the really strong effect that subject choice can have on whether or not somebody ends up going to university. And then we have work, colleagues, Natasha Pantic is doing work. She's just launched a new course, actually, at Murray House called Teachers as Agents of Change, looking at the kinds of things individual teachers can do in their class to make a difference. We have a really active, one of our three institutes in Murray House is the PE Sports and Health Science. And I know that there's work going on there. Shirley Gray is doing some work there, looking at connections between physical health and attainment. And Lynn Pratt is also doing some work with a secondary school. I can't remember the name of the project, but she's doing, I think that's got more of a focus on pedagogy, if I remember correctly. And then we've got, the other kind of, you know, obviously we're a university, so quite a lot of what we do is teaching. And I think there's a number of different courses and programs that Murray House offer, which address our attainment gap kind of issues. In particular, there's a suite of programs on additional support needs, and actually the Teachers as Agents of Change course sits within that suite of programs. And that's the kind of thing which I think we would be, you know, schools are getting a lot of money through the Pupil Equity Fund at the moment, and one of the things that we would hope schools would see as a valuable thing to spend that on would be additional training for staff. And I saw again today in that report from the Scottish Government that one of the things they're really interested in doing is increasing the capacity of teachers and leaders within schools of using data and understanding how you can use data. So something like our MSc in Educational Research would be, I think, quite useful for people there. So mainly it's the kind of the large-scale quantitative stuff. So that's people like Lindsay Patterson, Christina Ionelli, and then they've got the widening participation group, and I'm going to forget somebody, and that's going to be terrible, but it's kind of headed by Sheila Riddell, and then there's Elizabeth Whedon and Lucy Hunter-Blackburn, is that right? Sarah Minty, various people working at that kind of end of the spectrum, if you like. And then we've got the group of people working on additional support needs and how we, you know, so Lani Florian's work on inclusive pedagogy and how we can make schools more inclusive. And then you've got the sports and PE people. And then there's a kind of a small group of people, which I'm sort of vaguely involved in. And then Julie McCluskey, for example, has just had a paper published in Education, Citizenship and Social Justice, which is a really good journal, actually, for people who are interested in looking at this kind of issue. And that's just looking at what the research, what we already know from research, that what do we already know about things that work for closing the attainment gap? Because actually there is a cumulative body of knowledge. And so she focuses there on parental engagement, on the ethos of schools and behaviour and kind of systems for promoting positive behaviour. And we also have a large kind of a cohort of staff who are involved in community learning. And of course, that's the professional background of the family learning workers I was talking about earlier, is they're all qualified community learning workers. And so there's a lot of work, I think, that their research is not always seen as being directly relevant to schools. I think sometimes we kind of assume that, well, the research has to be carried out in a school for it to be of use to the school. But actually a lot of stuff about learning in communities, about community activism, about, you know, engagement with local communities, about which actually has an impact on, you know, ultimately will have an impact on how the young people do in school. So I think it's about looking at things very broadly. And of course, I mean, going outside Murray House, then Morag Trainor's work from social policy is very pertinent here as well. She's kind of directly working in this area too. So lots of work going on.
Yes, yeah,
lots
was,
of
yeah.
courses going on. Yeah,
that was a really, really helpful run through, Gail. And obviously, earlier on in the show, you gave out your email address as well. And I mean, if we get any comments through the website or Twitter, we'll be sure to pass them on to you. But no, thank you so much for giving up your time this evening to appear on the show. It's you know my background in education, Gail, and it's I found all of it very, very fascinating, and it's something that I'll reflect on in the days to come. So thank you so much again. And would love to have you on the show sometime in the future.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. My pleasure. All right, nice to speak to you, David.
Thanks a lot, Gail.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.